say shifting network is now mounted at the antenna. So you can do all of this at the antenna, and one feed line can go up there. However, if you decide to run two completely separate feed lines from the horizontal driven element and the vertical driven element all the way down to the shack, it does give you one extra capability. By switching phasing harness cable lengths in the shack with the switching network, you can now decide to select clockwise circular polarization, counterclockwise circular polarization, linear horizontal, linear vertical, linear slant 45 degrees right, linear slant 45 degrees left. You have complete polarization adaptability if you bring those two feed lines into the shack and put them into the right kind of a switching network. Now, by remote control, you could make that switching network right up at the antenna if you wanted to with one separate feed line. So how the energy gets there, the driven elements don't care. But as long as the horizontal driven element and vertical driven element have equal amplitude and 90 degrees out of phase, including a spatial offset, then you will have circular polarization. Over to you, John. KG2, FQU, mobile. KQI, WDF, net.
Someone's copying you, covering you, Dick. The corkscrew or helix, they call it both, but this circular rotation, you know, reflector behind the corkscrew.
What I was trying to say is that if you go to any of the antenna game competitions and you look at the recorded results, a high percentage of the circular polarized antennas were very disappointing. There's lots of circular polarized, lots of helical antennas out there, and very few of them are working well. That's what I'm saying, Hal. Go ahead.
I agree. They don't accept a gate, but they do have circular polarization. The gate factor is not there. I go along with that. But circular rotation, circular polarization, they do have. And you know, well, they're using them in tracking for missiles and so on and so forth.
The guy who runs the antenna game competition of the East Coast VHS, Central States VHS Society, he has made lots of measurements on amateur-built helical antennas following well-respected designs. He then measured their circularity. He found the gain is a lot lower than expected. The circularity was really terrible. At best, it's elliptical. Some of them are almost linear. So the history of circular polarized, of helical antennas built by amateurs, observed for multiple years at the Central States VHS Society antenna game competitions by Kent Britton, WA5EJB, is very disappointing. That's my point. So know that you're walking into a minefield if you decide to build a helical antenna because you want pure circular polarization of reasonable gain. The history is very poor, and so once you know that ahead of time, you know to be a little bit more careful and do some more checking. I wonder if you see it that way, Hal. K6DPZ, K2LAW.
I agree. The gate is not the greatest. You have to use more pre-amplification using the receiver applications. But it is a circular type of polarization antenna. Go ahead, Jim. K2RIW, K6DPZ.
Now, although I've said a number of negative things about helical antennas, arguably one of the world's highest gain helical antennas that was ever built was built by Dr. John Krause, W-H-A-K. He is the creator of the helical antenna, by the way. You can read about it in his book called Antennas, McGraw Hill, 1950. And he built an array of 96, count them, 96 helical antennas in Miamisburg, Ohio, and that was his first significant 1420 megahertz radio telescope, 96 helical antennas. It can be done. But he's the guy who created the helix. So be careful. there's a lot more to circular polarization, as you can tell, that first meets the eye, John. But maybe we've scratched the surface a little bit for you. If some of this is convincing, confusing, you're in good company. The majority of antenna engineers and the majority of antenna and electronic engineers have a lot of trouble with this one. And we're going to have to discuss it a number of times. Don't feel bad about that. KD2FQU, mobile, K2RAW in the deck net.
Come on out, Dick.
John first. Go ahead, John.
Thank you. I really do hear how information on the corkscrew. I've seen some information on the web. I will approach this later on. I do appreciate that information. The last question was, is it possible, as you did say, it's possible to use one single feed line. What would be the application for connecting both horizontal and vertical dipoles for across the Yagi?
To put two Yagis together, one horizontal and one vertical, you're starting off from something that's got a good track record. A well-designed Yagi works well. A well-designed Yagi held horizontal and polarization works well. A well-designed Yagi held vertical and polarization works well. And if you make two Yagis slap together, boom to boom, one horizontal and one vertical, because they're at right angles to each other, they are thoroughly orthogonal electronically. They do not see each other. They do not couple together. They are two independent antennas. Even though you have physically put them touching each other, they do not see each other. If you do it carefully, you can transmit the 100 watts into antenna horizontal and look at how much power is there in vertical, and it will be very small. They are independent. So once you start off with two well-track record antennas, and they're independent, and one's horizontal, one's vertical, and you know that that's what's required to make good circular polarization, and now you properly see them, you're almost home free. You see all the advantage of going that way. If you want high gain, and you want circular polarization, I know of very few ways that are going to do it better, other than starting off with a 28-foot diameter dish, and maybe you don't have one of those yet, John, but keep an eye out for it. KD2FQU, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KD2, yes.
Yeah, stand by, John. Here's a guy who uses circular polarization a lot to talk to your satellites. Broadcaster, John, Eric, KD2EJ, tell us something about this one, Eric.
Well, I'm just going to suggest you make it easy. I've been used to manufacturing what was called an Oscar antenna. It's a single boom with the elements based 90 degrees apart. They look like two Yagis, you know, the cross element antenna. I think with 11 elements, that's pretty reasonable game to have one of them, but it's used for years for the satellite work. It has the power divided and the phasing harness. Fortunately, they used RG-174, but it works quite well with the relay up there. You can call up the relay and reverse the polarization of the antenna. I don't know if they still manufacture it. I'm not sure they do, but occasionally you'll come across one. You do. That makes the whole thing really easy. Well, you can do what I did, and that's to take an existing really good antenna and drill holes in it and make my own. Try them, you can't do it yet.
So as Eric was saying, there once was, and maybe there still is, a commercial product that does it. But Eric said another very interesting thing. Because I had a number of 19 element Yagis in my backyard, and in the spur of the moment I wanted circular polarization, I roped them together, so to speak, as I just mentioned before, with hose clamps. If you're designing from scratch, the sophisticated way of doing it would be to drill the holes in the boom for the horizontal elements, drill the holes in the boom for the vertical elements, offset them a little bit, and now all the elements are on the exact same boom, again not seeing each other. But be a little bit warned about something else. When it comes to Yagi elements that are more than, let me pick a number, four or so, five elements long, do not plug the elements directly into the aluminum boom. Insulate them from the boom, because aluminum to aluminum oxide will build up outside. There's no way of stopping it. The only thing left to discuss is how long it takes. Let me drop. So if you make a moderately long or a long Yagi with elements through the boom, it may work like a charm the day you build it. A year later, you go down those elements with an ohm meter and you'll find that half of those elements are now making no contact to the boom at all because of aluminum oxide. As they break contact with the boom, they go to a detuning process. Now you've got an antenna on some other frequency, and it may fire in the wrong direction, backwards instead of forward. Lots of history has gone along those lines. So I'm a very strong advocate of insulating the elements from the boom by whatever means. Doing it with shoulder bushings by going through the boom, or a box of plastic on top. Go ahead, Eric.
Comment, Dick.
Yeah, you can get the fiber washers and the clips that all the elements from the DX engineering. There's a couple places you can get them, but you gotta use them.
Okay, and who's the other person? Want to make comment?
Kilo 1, Mike 2, we have Mike.
Okay, Mike number 2, go right ahead.
Roger, this is K1MJM. If somebody's looking for a commercially available circular polarized antenna, M squared or M2 makes a whole assortment of them for in different frequencies for satellite communication for amateurs. K1MJM, back over to you.
Good information, Mike. And by the way, the mic you're hearing right now is the owner of that second website, which is entitled LimarkTechNet.com. You go there and you'll see some very good information. The very first website, the Mike and Mike websites I call them, is AmateurRadio.TangoVictor. AmateurRadio.TangoVictor has all the past recordings for the last 7 years approximately of this technical net. And Mike, number two, MJM, the one you're just hearing about with his LimarkTechNet.com website, has an awful lot of very good information, some pictures. You can see a crazy selfie picture of a guy on a 100-foot tower taking a picture of himself. So, good information. Circular polarization has a lot of advantages, a couple of disadvantages, a little bit difficult, lots of misunderstandings, and so go a little bit slow, ask lots of questions, do a little bit of research. It's probably worth doing it, John. I'm kind of curious, are you thinking about doing this for satellite work? KD2FQU Mobile, K2IW in the TechNet. That was a triple. I think Hal is saying he's leaving us and he wants to make a last comment. Go ahead, Hal.
My comment is, take your boom on the PEC, you know, tubing, and then you can drill holes through it, put your elements through it vertically and horizontally, and you can have your circular rotation antenna, and if you won't have too many headaches when you put it together. 73 gentlemen, J6 DVC clear.
Okay, that was an opinion expressed by Hal as to how it works. For me, it's not so good. You get a hell of a lot more strength to weight ratio out of aluminum than you do PVC. And if it's a long boom Yagi, sags, it looks a little bit more homely. It's not as pleasing to me, but that's just me. Hal's built a PVC Yagi, he likes them. What is your intended use of the circular polarized antenna, John? That may help us a little bit. KD2FQU, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Comment again until we know we get a chance.
Thank you very much, Dick. K2RIW, this is KD2FQU. Ed, starting point, I haven't created one yet. I would like to move up to satellite access contacts at some point, probably in the next year. But, simple local use, I was able to share with my new antenna, Larson, 36-inch 2/70 C is the model. And that's why I'm able to cover this tech while I'm actually sitting outside my apartment. I was able to make a single sideband acceptance there, as you said, altitude, elevation, elevation. I was able to make contact with a lot of people. small 2 meters, about 3 feet apiece on either side for a dipole. And same for work. So I haven't yet decided on what application, but a single element jagged first, and then probably move my way up to a beam.
Okay, so satellite work is what I'm hearing is your main purpose for this, John. And bear in mind that many of the satellites, there is pretty good circular polarization when they're at apogee, when they're in their most desirable point of usage. Some of the satellites, particularly the ones that have an elliptical orbit, sometimes on the backside of their orbit, so to speak, they're opposite in circular polarization or somewhat elliptical, not purely circular. And if you have designed enough adaptability into your antenna, polarization adaptability, you can conform to what's going on each portion of its orbit and pick up some additional advantage. I know that the Rich wants to make another comment. Try to keep it brief though, Rich. We've already spent 55 minutes on your subject. N2EO, KQLAW.
Hi,
that
was good. You mentioned John Krause, WHJK. Question. He said he worked out of Miamisburg, Ohio. I think it's a fairly small town. I wonder if it's a coincidence that the RL Drake company is in Miamisburg, Ohio. They used to make ham gear. They've been out of the ham gear business for a number of years. I wonder if that's a coincidence or what. And didn't WHJK write a book? I didn't read it. Called The Big Year, and I think he worked out of Seabrook.
I call for the mic, Rich. Stop yelling. I may be wrong on Miamisburg, Ohio. I visited his radio telescope site, and it was close to Columbus, and I'll have to go back to my notes on that one. He did write a book about that very large radio telescope, which is second or third version at that particular site, which by the way doesn't exist, and the book called Big Ear is in version 1, edition 1, as well as edition 2, and a very good reading. John Krause, WHJK, has a beautiful classic book called Radio Astronomy. Very well written. If you get a hold of that, you want to read it. He's also got the book called Antennas in edition number 1, 2, and 3. These are considered a Bible that comes in the subject of antennas. He is the inventor of the helical antenna. He is the inventor of many of the concepts by which antennas are defined and tested and so on. So almost anything he has written, get your hands on it, buy it, even if it's expensive, you can't go wrong. We got to go on now to John number 2, Whiskey Alpha 2, Victor David Hotel, K2LIW. Hope you're still with us, John, K2LIW.
Oh yeah, fine business. Thanks, Nick. Very good evening to the net. My question has to do with noise figure. In the October, the current issue of QST, the October issue, the new one just out, there's a very nice article by Paul Wade, W1 Gigahertz, discussing the DB. It's a very well-written article. But there's a statement in there that I was just wondering if you could comment on. He mentions that 1 dB of feedline loss increases the system noise figure by 1 dB. I was just going through some calculations where I just take an amplifier, say with some gain, and then I stick a pad in front of it and see what the new noise figure is, and it doesn't quite seem to add up. I was wondering if you could comment on that case, say an amplifier with and without, let's say a 3 dB pad in front of it, to see if it does increase the noise figure by 3 dB. Go ahead.
Used correctly, any insertion loss that is at room temperature that's in front of an amplifier adds directly to its noise figure. If I got a 1 dB amplifier and I put 3 dB of room temperature insertion loss between it and the antenna. My system just went from 1 dB to a 4 dB noise figure. It increases dB for dB. And it's even hard to believe that if I started off with a terrible amplifier with a 10 dB noise figure and I put 3 dB of loss in front of it, it will be 13 dB of noise figure if the insertion of loss is at room temperature. If you can cryogenically cool that insertion loss, as crazy as that sounds, Bell Laboratories did that at one of their ground stations. They had a piece of waveguide that had a couple of dB of loss, as I remember, between the real antenna and where they could mount their very elaborate parametric amplifier 20 or 30 years ago. And they literally cryogenically cooled that piece of waveguide to drastically lower the amount of noise figure it increased because of its insertion loss. So you don't add noise figure dB for dB if it's colder than room temperature. Conversely, if that insertion loss is hotter than room temperature, you'll be adding more noise. If I had a 3 dB pad and I aim a blowtorch at it, I might increase the noise figure of the amplifier not by 3 dB, but by 4 or 5 dB. Noise temperature, noise figure, kind of a complicated subject. But if you really want best sensitivity, let me drop. If you want the best sensitivity of your noise figure, of your moonbound system, for instance, or your ground station system, your satellite system, you want the best possible sensitivity. You got to do two or three things just right. Number one, you've carefully adjusted that preamplifier for its best noise figure when it's connected to a automatic noise figure indicator that has exactly 50.0 ohms of resistive impedance. You put any other impedance on that preamplifier input connector, like an antenna with a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, you have a brand new noise figure, probably higher. So you got to make sure you got a good impedance match between the input connector of the preamp, and you want to lower the amount of insertion loss as best you can. As such, if you're really serious, you're going to be mounting the preamplifier at the antenna, unless you're willing to use inch and 5/8 Andrew Heliacs to make the insertion loss low enough. So there's a whole lot of things going to be done just right if you really want to get best performance out of an LNA, as they call it, low noise amplifier. There's only 10 ways you can do it wrong, John, number two. I'll warn you. WA2VDH, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, fine business, Nick, but if noise figure or noise ratio before you put it into dB is the signal noise ratio at the input divided by the signal to noise ratio at the output, the pad is not going to change the input signal to noise ratio because it attenuates both the incoming signal and the incoming noise. True, the amplifier is still generating its own internal amplifier noise, but when you put that into dB and take the 10 log of what's coming in, or the 10 log of the output signal noise ratio, I mean, since the input is not changing, I assume all the change is due at the output, and it's really that the amplifier noise is staying the same. The amplified noise is when it gets smaller, as I think. Go ahead.
Okay, you've been led to believe that the bad news is happening at the output of the amplifier. 99% of the time, that's not true. It's happening at the input. If you were running a real good radio telescope, John, and I took a 50 ohm perfect attenuator, 50 ohm termination, a 50 ohm dummy load, and I connected to real good laboratory instrumentation, I will measure noise power coming out of that 50 ohm dummy load. That noise power will be exactly minus 114 dBm per megacycle at room temperature. In other words, you make a careful measurement how much noise power is happening because of the random motion of the electrons that are in your 50 ohm dummy load. For each megacycle of bandwidth, the noise power will be minus 114 dBm to the nearest tenth of a dB. Take that 50 ohm termination that I just described, cryogenically cool it, I can give you a formula that will tell you exactly how much less noise power you get. Or conversely, you heat it up with a blowtorch, so to speak, it will make more noise. Every insertion loss is really a signal flowing through, and it's got a paired equivalent. That's what the insertion loss really means. Anything that has insertion loss has the capability of generating noise. On top of that, you're preamplifying. Let me drop. Your preamplifier has, in theory, a defined noise figure, which means it's got a certain noise source equivalent at its front end that's always there. You put a pad in front of it. Two things happen. One, the signal you want to feed through is getting weaker. Therefore, that weaker signal is now competing with the noise of the preamplifier. The preamplifier is always making some noise. Your signal got weaker, therefore your signal-to-noise ratio got worse for that factor. There's a second factor. The preamp, the noise, the insertion loss between the antenna and your preamplifier is, in almost all cases that you and I work with, at room temperature. Just like the 50-ohm termination, it is generating a second source of noise. So now, your preamplifier input has a weaker signal and two sources of noise, the one from your attenuator and the one from your preamplifier. Those two sources of noise are incoherent with each other. So therefore they add by way of a quadrature or a power relationship. You put it all together because of every situation where you've got an insertion loss, there's three things going on. The signal that goes through, the noise that comes through, the noise that gets generated by the noise, by the attenuation, and the fact that all of that is competing with the noise of the amplifier. The bottom line of all this, when you finally get the mathematics correct, I'm 95% sure, John, you're going to find out that a 3 dB pad at room temperature, a 3 dB attenuation of any kind, cable, hybrid, attenuator, whatever, a 3 dB attenuation at room temperature will increase whatever noise figure your preamplifier has by 3 dB. I know it's not an easy one to accept at first. When we get deep enough into it, I'm pretty sure I can convince you of this one, John. The B2VDH, and by the way, Paul Wade, the B1 said that this was repeater. Time out. WA1ZZF is what it's called, as it used to be. WA2ZZF is now
Gigahertz.
Gigahertz. He's run noise figure competitions at the East Coast VHF Society, and the he's done a lot of noise figure measurements, so an awful lot of what he says is pretty close to traceable to the Bureau, John. WA2VDH, K2LAW.
I see. Okay, yeah, I think the thing I was ignoring was the noise from the pad. It's being uncorrelated, so it's like another independent noise source that just directly adds. So, I could see how that would account for it. Okay, fine business. Yeah, this is a very well-written article that Paul wrote here. It's in the October issue there about DB. I'm thinking of making copies of it. It's a very good article. Okay, Sam, thanks for the information, and we'll be listening. WA2VDH, bye.
As you're about to find out, John, number two, there's a lot of art and science to getting really low noise, super sensitive receivers. And so, with modern day gallium arsenide field effect transistors that are hemp, high electron mobility, and indium nitride and whatever, these exotic materials, FET-like transistors, if you have the ability to cryogenically cool the preamplifier, oh boy, can you get sensitivity out of those things. So, the people who run the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Green Bank, West Virginia, they are using these kind of techniques in many cases. The best possible low noise preamplifiers, and then they add to them cryogenic cooling, and so that, to make a joke, if somebody strikes a match on the moon, you're going to peg the needle of your radio telescope on the Earth. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but when it comes to these super sensitive things, looking at a cold background sky of Earth, I mean, the 3 degrees Kelvin, 2.73 degrees Kelvin of the majority of the universe, boy, can you get super sensitivity.
Not always, let me drop. Not always can you do this on terrestrial communications, because when you and I aim that antenna at the horizon, half of it is seeing cold sky and half of it is seeing hot earth when that antenna is aimed at the horizon. You think you got a nice pencil beam out there, it's a great big cucumber shaped antenna pattern, so to speak, and half of that pattern is looking at hot earth, and so there have been radio ground stations, satellite ground stations, where the noise coming from Earth, ordinary dirt, making noise, because it's a resistive volumetric material, and that noise comes into the back lobes of your satellite system, your ground station, and degrades the overall system gain to temperature ratio. That's a fancier way of talking about noise figure. As such, there have been a number of ground stations where they literally spread metallic screening on the ground behind the dish so that the noise of the earth cannot get into the back lobes. Now that reflective material on the ground is reflecting nothing but cold sky into the back lobes of the dish, and the system increases in sensitivity. It sounds heroic, it's not an expensive technique, and you pick up improvement for doing it. And some of the high-class ground stations have done that. There's a lot more to the story, as you can tell. You'll be asking us more questions in the future, John. We got to go over to Hank now. November 1, Yankee, Delta Yankee, if he's still with us. K2LIW, go ahead, Hank.
This is N1YDY. I've got the telephone call, so I'm going to have to pass. Thank you, gentlemen.
Hank, make a guess. How long will your phone call be? Should we come back to you?
Give me about 10 minutes. That would be great.
We might be able to squeeze you in then. Okay, the next person who signed in, and I'm not sure if he was really just letting us know he's there or if he really had a question, was Freddie. Victor Bravo November. Freddie, go right ahead if you're there. K2LIW. If you made us a call, we may have missed it. Freddie, Victor Bravo November, are you there? K2LIW.
KB2VBN.
KB2VBN, who signed in earlier. Well, we assume he has a question. And his name is Freddie. He's about to give us his question right now. Go right ahead, Freddie. You're number one on the runway.
It's April 28th. The tornadoes of Arkansas destroyed 50 houses.
Okay, April 28th, Arkansas tornado destroyed a lot of houses. What was your question about that, Freddie? Go ahead.
April 28th, Arkansas, there were 28 tornadoes that crashed down there and destroyed 50 houses. What frequencies on the high band did they use for emergencies to communicate with the outside world?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wonder if anyone else here knows this. April 28th, so 28 tornadoes, 50 houses destroyed, and what emergency communications were used. And I guess what you're sort of asking left-handedly is of any of the emergency communications that are set up by your municipality as well as the ham radio operators in an environment like that, how much of that communication network will survive? Will the antenna and the tower still stand? Will the power supply still be there? Is there enough standby power and so on? Anybody have any information on this? Give me a call with us right now. K2LIW listening. Freddy, the report that you read, where were you reading that?
I read it in the Silver Air Patrol magazine called Volunteer.
And what issue was that you read that in, Fred? Go ahead.
what is it? July, between July and September 2014.
Okay, it sounds to me like you've got more information than the rest of us. Up here, not many of us have close enough contacts with people there to know enough about this event. You've asked an interesting question, and I think you've stumped us tonight, Freddy. I don't know if anyone in the area has a good answer for you. Back to you for the final. And then as you find out more about this, please come back and let us know what you find out, Freddy. KB2, VBN, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Roger, I will check it out some more. We're going to find out what the HF bands they use.
Okay, so that'll be delayed. Let's go over to the mailbag before we go back to Hank, who's on the phone call right now. So, what kind of challenging letters have we gotten this week? And also, I'm going to be leaving you guys at 10 o'clock. I've got an important appointment bright and early tomorrow morning, and I've got to be real fresh for it. So I'm going to have to leave you guys at 10 o'clock, and hopefully you guys can carry on without me after 10. KC2WGB, are they going to stump us again with these great questions, John? K2RIW will be in the tech net.
Well, maybe. Very good, Dick. Good evening. And first I have to put out a little bit of an apology to a 12-year-old gentleman who wrote us a question last week and took offense to the fact that he thinks it was insulting for Wesley to call him a liar, which he did. And I want to apologize to him and let him know that it's not a TechNet person who was saying that. We take all questions, all types. It doesn't matter what it is, as long as it's of interest. And I appreciate the question, and I'm sorry. He also notes that Wesley has difficulty with the language and maybe didn't realize he was doing that. No apologies required from he wants to get the whole thing. But he just found it unusual that somebody supposed to have a scientific mind bent would make a comment like that. So I just want him to know to please. He also has four other friends. They have these little scientific conferences. And when they come up with a question, they're posted on the net. So I just wanted to make it clear to him that that was not a member of the TechNet that designated that, by the way, Dick. I'll let it drop. I'll go on to the first question. KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, this gentleman has built a Faraday cage, basically. Inside of it, he has two coils. They're approximately 6 inches in diameter, multiple turns. He's using it for an attenuator. He's feeding his antenna from a 30-watt radio. He also uses it from his HT. His question is, he wants to be able to monitor the current in the output going to the antenna. As he separates the coils, it performs pretty well as an attenuator, but he has no idea of the currents or the voltages. So he'd like to, how can he hook up and what type of meter? He has no equipment other than a few digital voltmeters. I think he has one VTVM. So maybe you could tell him what he could do, what kind of shunt he could put in there, and where he could pick up those voltages. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB. And that's 2 meters, by the way.
There's a lot of ways of doing this. Not all of them are easy. Some of them are easier. I'm going to start off with the ideal world, and we'll slowly get into the non-ideal world. If this is an ideal world, the antenna on 2 meters, for instance, is well impedance matched. It's got a low standing wave ratio. We'll assume it's very close to a 50-ohm termination on the end of a transmission line. The 50-ohm transmission line leading to that antenna, that transmission line is coming from this variable attenuator, this unusual variable attenuator, which is two coils in a Faraday shield. And I'm guessing those two coils, you either rotate one versus the other, and it's called a goniometer, and therefore you change the coupling between the two coils. But that's one way of doing it. Changing the separation between the two coils is another. sliding a shield between the two coils is a third. There's a lot of ways that you can change the coupling between the two coils and therefore change the amount of attenuation. Let me drop. Now for the coils themselves, if this is the world's best environment, the coils would each present a 50 ohm impedance. Now that's going to be kind of impossible, because as you rotate one coil versus the other and the coupling coefficient between the coils changes, even if the coil was carefully adjusted to be a 50 ohm load at 2 meters for one particular orientation, at some other orientation, it's not a 50 ohm load anymore. That's not a showstopper. It's just something to know about. You're allowed to have a signal source which is not a 50 ohm source, and everything can still be reasonably well calibrated if you know what you're doing if the rest of the system is 50 ohms. If I had a very high standing wave ratio antenna and a high standing wave ratio variable attenuator and a piece of transmission line in between the two, and now we've got a lot of unknowns. Let me drop. But since a guy can go to that article that I've written on how to get a perfect impedance match to a 2 meter driven element of a Yagi, for instance, any dipole can give you a perfect impedance match with a little bit of tuning if you follow that procedure, the RIW, the Yagi tuning procedure, that's in the bottom of the page on, well, it's on Mike Number 2's website now. That's the one that says LimarTechNet.com. That tuning procedure is there. You can also see it on WA1MJM, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Juliet Alpha .org. At the bottom of his page, his microwave page, that's Dr. Tom Williams. So you can get a hold of this article that tells you how to perfectly impedance match the driven element of a Yagi or a dipole or whatever. You can make the antenna perfect without doing anything heroic. It's fairly easy to do, even though it's not well described in any of the books that you normally get a hold of. Let me drop. So once your antenna is a good load, once you've got a reasonable piece of coaxial cable, maybe 50 ohms going to it, with properly installed connectors so things are shielded, now three quarters of your system is defined. Any signal that flows down that cable is going to go down the cable once, none of it's going to reflect back, all of it's going to be radiated by the antenna, and now that is a quantifiable system. Now how do you measure the amount of power going down that cable in that case? In theory, you could put a T-connector on there and measure voltage. That's not easy, but it could be done. A more preferred way is to buy or build a directional coupler. Now, the directional coupler, if you try to go out and buy a directional coupler for 144 megacycles, you'll find out they're as rare as hen's teeth. There are very few of them, and the few that exist are going to be expensive. Don't let that be a showstopper. Good job. You can take a directional coupler for any higher frequency. Like where I wanted a directional coupler with a very small coupling coefficient, because I was running a 300 watt transmitter and I was going into instrumentation that can only take a fraction of a watt, I needed a whole lot of attenuation to get good impedance match. I literally started off with a directional coupler designed for 10 gigahertz, and I used it at 144 megacycles. And I'm trying, I think I've got an article on that one. I believe it's also on Mike's webpage. Yes, it is. On Mike Number 2's webpage. That's the one that's labeled LimarTechNet.com. There's an article in there telling you how to do directional coupler calibration. Once you read that article, you'll be halfway to either getting a very inexpensive directional coupler that's on the wrong frequency and using it exactly the way you want to use it on 2 meters. We drop. And the next step, if you're really short on cash, building a directional coupler. You'd be amazed how easy that is to do. The hardware that goes inside is a dollar's worth. I'm not kidding. There's about a dollar's worth of hardware inside of a good directional coupler if you're homebrewing it. You can homebrew it. By way of the directional coupler, you can make traceable to the Bureau standards, by laboratory standards always, you can find out how much signal is flowing from your variable attenuator down that cable toward the antenna. And the signal will only flow down there once if you've done a good job of impedance matching that antenna. So measuring the amount of signal, he said measuring the current. That's a slightly naive way of going. To measure current on the semiconductor of a coax cable at 144 megacycles is not easy. But current creates signal, and you can measure signal amplitude. A directional coupler will tell you, hey, that's a 1 milliwatt signal, or it's a tenth of a milliwatt signal. Once you know it's a tenth of a milliwatt signal, and you know it's on a 50-ohm cable, you know exactly how much voltage is there. You know exactly how much current is there. You don't have to measure the voltage. You don't have to measure the current. Measure how much power is flowing forward with your directional coupler. As you can see, what looks like a common sense measurement. Let me drop. In the old days of HF, where you're operating at a very low frequency, and you literally put a meter that measures the current that flows through the wire that went to the antenna. And when they pick a number 1 megacycle, you can do that. At 144 megacycles, you cannot do that. You can't make a current meter small enough that it won't disturb the living daylights out of the system. You don't have to disturb the system. A directional coupler does not disturb the system. With it, you can measure the magnitude of forward power. From that, you can calculate, if you want to, exactly how much current it equals and exactly how much voltage it equals. He really wants to know power, in my opinion. And so if he starts thinking in a power relationship and converting that to dBs if he likes, he's going to be a lot closer to making measurements traceable to the Bureau, sensible measurements, not very difficult. There's a little more to the story, as you can tell, but I'm trying to lead him in the right direction, doing it in a way that other scientists, I think, will accept. Maybe that helps a little, John. KC2WGB, K2RAW in the tech net.
Very good, Dick. If you mind, please give him the formulas. I'm not sure he knows the formulas. If he measures the power, if he wants to calculate current, okay, just give him the formulas and he'll be able to do that.
Okay, one particular formula that's always very useful. Power equals E squared over R. E is voltage, R is resistance. If E is voltage in RMS volts, and resistance is ohms, power equals E squared over R. You can rearrange that equation. E squared equals PR. Take the square root of both sides. E squared, square root of it is E. Therefore, E equals the square root of power times resistance. So if you measure the power in units of watts, you may have really measured milliwatts or microwatts. Then you can convert that into watts. A milliwatt is 0.001 watts, so to speak. And a microwatt is a 0.501. So make sure the power is units of watts. And if you've done a good job of calibrating the antenna's impedance, it is 50 ohms, so R is 50. So power times 50, square root of it, is volts. And there's a similar formula for current. I squared R, power equals I squared R, yes. Power equals I squared R. If you wanted to know the current, I'm going to rearrange the equation. I squared equals P over R. Therefore, I equals the square root of P over R. So, once you know that power equals E squared over R, and power equals I squared R, rearranging it, taking the square root, you can now take any amount of power, convert it into volts if that's what you want, or convert it into current if that's what you want. I know that went by a little bit fast, but by way of the website where this is all recorded and you can play it back, and you're allowed to ask the question again, you'll eventually get it. And John, your table will repeat it for him if need be. KC2WGB, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, maybe I'll email him those formulas. That might be helpful, and we'll see how he makes out. All right, let me make it. I'll drop in one more question before we go to Paul.
Yeah, the one thing that we didn't make clear is that by way of the directional coupler, it's now much more accurate, much more traceable to the Bureau. The directional coupler is sampling some of the signal that's flowing forward on that cable and displaying it on that directional port. However, you've now got to hang something there that is a detector. you and I, of course, with the right kind of laboratory instrumentation, we would hang a power meter there. We would hang a spectrum analyzer. The power meter is good for measuring power down to, let me pick a number, or a small fraction of a milliwatt. If you want to measure weaker power than that, you could probably have to use a spectrum analyzer. A good spectrum analyzer can measure signals down to the micro-microwatts, if you know what I mean. So, some kind of a laboratory traceable detector. You could, if you want to, build a homebrew voltmeter by using a diode rectifier into a capacitor, into a load resistor, and plugging that into your vacuum tube voltmeter. That, as a schematic diagram, looks simple and it works. Let me drop. The problem of calibrating it is a little bit tough. If you were running with voltages like 10 volts RMS, and you used a diode rectifier that can tolerate 20 volts peak inverse voltage, a diode rectifier and measuring the DC voltage you get out of it, it'll give you accuracy of 5% error, 95% accuracy, if you know what I mean. So for strong voltages, a diode rectifier as a homebrew voltage sensing device works like a charm. For small voltages, you've got a problem. Even a Schottky diode takes 2/10 of a volt of forward voltage before it starts conducting significantly. So if you're trying to measure 1/10 of a volt of RMS and you're using a Schottky diode, it will respond, but it's responding in a very different way. It's a so-called square law response, and there's some articles written on the subject, but the voltage that you're measuring and the voltage that you the voltage that you're trying to sense and the voltage that you're going to sense after your diode rectifier are going to be very different than a simple calculation, if you know what I mean. So, building homebrew detectors for small magnitude signals is troublesome. I'm not saying that that's a showstopper. I'm just letting you know where the minefield is. That portion of it's going to be a little bit difficult. If somebody in your environment has a real power meter or a real spectrum analyzer, you'll be way ahead of the game using that directional coupler. KC2WGB, K2RAW.
This is Tomlin from HWW.
You know, on the, just for his information, on places like eBay, I have purchased many HP detectors. They're about maybe 2 inches long. They look like a dummy load, and they have end connectors on them, and they're not expensive. He can get something like that for $20, sometimes $15, and if he uses that along with the VTVM, I think he can get, you know, in the ballpark.
HWW, a comment on the subject?
Yeah, if you would have found a way, Howie, of making very inexpensive, low-power detecting devices that give you a calibrated response, what would you, Howie?
Well, when I was at college, somebody had an amplifier. They took an amplifier, a broadband video amplifier, and did it that way, Dick. And they had it calibrated. The only thing you had to take into effect was any noise figure. You can do it that way, Dick. Go ahead.
You know, now you're talking, Howie. As I said before, if you get your voltage up to, let me pick a number, 5 volts or so, a diode detector with a little bit of English to it, so to speak, Kentucky vintage, can give you a very accurate response, 5 volts. 0.5 volt, it's getting difficult. 0.05 volts, getting very difficult. Modern day transistorized amplifiers and these little free terminal things you can buy from Mini Circuits, among other places. For $1, you can buy an amplifying device with, let me pick the number, 10, 15, maybe even 20 decibels of gain. So if you take that weak signal coming out of the calibrator bowl, directional coupler, put it into one of these $1 amplifier assemblies, and now build up your signal that you want to measure to the point where it is something like 5 volts, and now put that into a diode rectifier, now you've got your cake and eat it too. You've got reasonable amplitudes to measure, reasonable calibration accuracy, not a whole lot of dollars. But once again, you're measuring power. You're going to interpret it into a voltage or current later on if that's what you want, but direct power measurement in a 50-ohm system is, I think, the right way to go, and Howie's made a good suggestion on that one. KC2WGB, K2RI.
So, could you use something like a gas tank preamp, like a broadband preamp from the fast receiver research, something like that? They have some stuff out there that you can do it. And that's a little more expensive, but you're right, these little monolithic chips are very easy to work with. You just have to make sure that you don't run into compression, that's it. You gotta make sure that you have enough, that the amplifier has enough overhead room.
The output voltage that your amplifier is capable of producing before it starts compressing is calculatable. If your power supply going into that amplifier is 5 volts DC, don't expect to get 10 volts RMS out of there. No way in hell. If you expect 1 volt out of it, beautiful. So the amount of voltage coming out of an amplifier that creates compression is guessable, calculatable, determinable, and so on. So once you know that your amplifier is taking your weak signal, if it happens to be weak, building it up to a point where you can easily measure it with a diode rectifier and make sure that your preamplifier is not saturating. And by the way, even if your preamplifier is saturating, there's nothing stopping you from turning that variable attenuator down to the point where it doesn't saturate and then make the measurement. And then it is too difficult to buy or build an attenuator that you put after the directional port of the coupler so that you step by step you can work your way up into higher power and not keep the, and make sure you keep the preamplifier from saturating. I think you see the step by step process that we're slowly walking into here, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Thank you for that information, Howie. Might be useful for him. I'm sure he's going to have a lot of fun with this. Evidently, the attenuator is working, and he is using it by separating the coils. They're parallel in the chamber from what I see on the drawing, and he just draws them out and reduces the output. Okay, I think we should turn it over to Paul. I know you're going to leave soon, so we'll have to get Paul online, and we'll pick up the rest next week. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
The guy up in Connecticut, Dick.
Yes. Hank, let's see if he's come back off the phone. November 1, Yankee, Delta Yankee, K2RIW, go right ahead, Hank.
RIW N1YDY, thanks for getting back to me, Dick. I have what I hope is a relatively quick question. I'm planning to do a 2-meter antenna install on a Jeep Cherokee-type vehicle, and I have a couple of options. One is a quarter wave in on the roof, basically taking advantage of the largest ground plane available, and the other is a 5/8 wave on the right front fender. And I was wondering if you had an opinion. I've understood from previous conversations that the 5/8 wave is a better deal than the quarter wave, in your opinion, for mobile mount, but on the other hand, the location isn't as good on a fender as it would be on the roof. So I was just wondering which of those you would recommend.
It turns out that when you're operating as low to the ground as you are with a vehicle, a mobile, altitude, I think, counts more. I would go for the quarter wave and or 5/8 wave, if you think you can swing it, on the roof. In the center of the roof, we get the great big ground plane of all that sheet metal, and the maximum altitude, you're going to get the best performance. Yeah, you've got a slight disadvantage of occasionally hitting branches of trees, and if it's a mag mount, it gets knocked down periodically. Or if it's a really bendable antenna, maybe it can take it. The nice thing about the antenna in the center of the roof, let me drop it. Is you get a nice clean pattern out of it. In other words, as you, if you were in the middle of a very large parking lot, and you were listening to a faraway repeater, and you drove circles in the parking lot, the signal strength you pick up is going to be fairly constant as long as there's not other reflecting devices in that parking lot with you. You put an antenna on the fender. One of the things that many people have discovered over the years is that when an antenna is not on the center of the vehicle, it tends to fire in the direction of the maximum mass of the vehicle. You put an antenna on the right front fender, you will get a definitely stronger signal toward the left rear end of the car. In other words, you know where the mass center of the car is. Start, make believe you're standing in the middle of your antenna, and you move and you point yourself in the direction of the mass center of the car. That's where you're going to get the maximum signal. So you're going to get a directional pattern off the fender and lower altitude, therefore